You're listening to The Brendan Murata Show.
So I feel my next project warrants some explanation, because there's that saying that if you were to ask people what they wanted at the turn of the century, most of them would have said a faster horse, when what they really wanted was a car. And when I've talked to people about what I'm going to do next, the suggestion that comes from many of them feels to me like a faster horse. So after doing my feature-length documentary, American Circumcision, which explored the growing movement against circumcision, the Intactivist movement, I had a few people suggest to me, we're going to do American Circumcision 2, right? Like, wouldn't that be great? Because the first film was such a success. And every time I've heard that suggestion, I've thought, what am I going to say in the second one that I didn't already say in the first one? You know, I put that out and it got a great response. It got seen on the largest platforms any film can possibly hope to go on. And I don't know what a second one is going to do that the first one didn't already do. And I don't know who would go to see a second film who didn't already see the first one and get whatever learnings they were meant to get out of it. In fact, I've been reluctant to do anything else on that subject matter entirely because I kind of felt like I said what I needed to say. I did do a follow-up book called The Intactivist Guidebook, and that came very much from what I was hearing from people who'd seen the film who were moved by it. And so I had a lot of people after I made that film reach out to me and say, I saw your film. I was really moved by it. What can I do to make a difference? And I saw a lot of people were doing things that weren't effective. When I learned about the issue, I thought about what skills that I had and put those skills to use in a way that I thought would create the most change, the most sharing of information, the largest impact I could. And what I saw a lot of people do once they saw the film is they immediately went towards the forms of activism they'd seen other people do, but not necessarily what was going to create the biggest impact. And so having watched the Intactivist movement for a long time, and then also done a year of reading just everything I could on the principles of activism, seeing activists from other movements, talking to some of them, trying things in my own life and my own trying to change people's hearts and minds and create change in the world. I put all of those into a book. And the book was basically a long letter to people I knew in the movement who had seen my film and were asking me that question, what can I do to make a difference? Part of the reason I didn't promote it heavily or do the same sort of launch campaign that I did for my film or I would do for other projects that I do is because it was really intended for people in the movement who are already in my audience and not just the whole general public. It was a very specific niche book. But this next book that I have been writing for the past year is not intended just merely for a smaller niche audience. This book I'm going to do a big launch for. And I think that if I do this launch right, if I get this book right, there is the potential for this book to be more impactful than the film that I made. I want to say that again, because I think that this book has the potential to be more impactful than the film that I made, which is a bold claim considering the amount of people who actually read a book versus the amount of people that sit at home and watch Netflix. Obviously, those numbers are such that more people will probably see a film than read a book. So why is it that this book has the potential to create a greater impact than even the film? Again, I want to go back to that earlier analogy that I stated, that what most people are asking for is a faster horse. And I think I've built my audience an iPod, which is part of the reason I want to explain it a little bit in this podcast and in the podcasts that are going to come between now and when the book launches. Right now, by the way, the guesstimated launch date for the book is February 2022. And that should give me enough time to do all of the things that I need to do before launch, although I am still editing and rewriting, even though I have a finished manuscript. And I've had a finished manuscript for over a year, but the nature of writing is that editing is rewriting. And so I took that and I brought it to an editor, and he gave me a lot of great feedback. And then I've shown it to a few other people, and then I've had my own thoughts just being with the material for a year. And so the process is such that I might be making small changes to it right up until the publication. And as of right now, the time I'm recording, there is a finished manuscript. And actually, I have had a draft of the entire book since last year, the summer of 2020. But I have wanted to be with the material that long, to rewrite that long, to make sure it is that good. Now, before I reveal the title of the book, I want to talk a little bit about how it came to be. Because as you know, over the summer of 2020, there was a lot of attention and focus on social justice movements. And even though my film had a lot of success and a huge impact, there was a part of me that thought, you know, I would like that impact, that success, to be even more. And I wondered why it was that despite sharing the message of that film with so many people, there wasn't a greater change in society. And this maybe was naive of me to think that one film, one piece of media would move the culture that much. But, you know, that's what I wanted to happen. So one of the things I've been thinking about since the release of the film is what it would take to create the level of change that I'd like to see happen. And that was part of the reason that I read and spent a year reading books on activism and social change theory and wrote the Intactivist Guidebook. And then over the summer of 2020, I saw massive attention and change being created around certain social justice movements. And I thought, I'd love to have the amount of success that those movements are having on the issues that I care about. Now, admittedly, a lot of these movements still have struggles of their own. They haven't made it all the way yet. They haven't gotten all the goals that they want, but they're doing well. So I'm thinking especially of the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020. That was a worldwide known hashtag movement trend. I'm thinking, for example, of Ibram Kendi's Institute, which received $10 million from the founder of Twitter. And, you know, again, there's still struggle. There are still things that those movements are working on. But I'd like to be at the level of struggle where organizations I care about get $10 million and have hashtags and slogans of theirs become worldwide brands. Of all the problems we could have, that seems like a high-quality problem for a movement. Now, some of the things they're responding to, obviously, are not high-quality problems. They're very challenging and difficult problems. But there are things that we could learn from the success of those movements. Whatever you think of those movements, there are things we can learn and model from that success. And so one of the things that I began to do, and honestly had been thinking about sort of in the back of my mind for earlier than that, but I really did over the summer of 2020, was read the underlying theory of those movements. And originally, I was thinking that I would do a book where I took some of the lessons and ideas of those movements and applied them to the issues that I care about. So what are the principles of social justice and what do those mean for example, the issue of genital cutting? Are there things that we could learn from those movements and apply to this issue and this movement? And originally I thought this is going to be like a 10,000 word book that maybe I sort of publish on Kindle and, you know, I give people a few lessons and pointers and hopefully they find it useful. And it ended up being a lot more than that. In fact, before I even began work on this book, I had a fantasy novel I wanted to do. I'd had this idea for a while, and I still intend to write this fantasy novel. And I got like a chapter in, and I was struggling with it. And then the idea for this other book came to me. And many writers talk about how ideas choose them. It's almost like that there is something else they're tuning into. But I didn't tune into this idea. This idea invaded my mind and said, I need you to write me. I've never had an idea grab me the way that this one did. And so I began to write, and I couldn't not write it. It was almost like the idea just possessed me, and I had to write it. And I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. And what I thought would be a 10,000 word book ended up becoming a 100,000 word book. I'll give you a reference as to how long that is. For those of you who aren't writers, the first Harry Potter novel is 70,000 words. And my book, The Intactivist Guidebook, was 30,000 words. So this is 100,000 words. This is a book. And I did a lot of research for this book because as I started to learn more about social justice and social justice movements, especially modern social justice movements, one of the things that became apparent to me was that they are not using the same model of the world and way of thinking about the challenges in the world that the intactivist movement is. So the intactivist movement is very much based in the idea of human rights. Human rights based in liberalism. So when I say liberalism, I mean capital L liberalism, the rights of man, John Locke liberalism, the style of government and freedom that extends all the way back to the founding of America, the movements for equality and egalitarianism that you could maybe even trace back to people like John Locke and the French Revolution and things like that. There's been a movement in the world for equality, for human rights, that has been going on for a very long time. And actually, I did a whole episode with a historian on the history of human rights if you want to learn more about that. But modern social justice movements are not working off of that. So if you were following, for example, the Black Lives Matter protests over the summer of 2020, how many times did you hear the phrase human rights come up? Probably not very many. You probably heard a lot about systemic racism or police brutality or the challenges of the system, but not as much of the phrase human rights, which is interesting because you could absolutely make a human rights argument for those movements and that many of the things that they're talking about, many of the issues they're protesting against are human rights violations. But that wasn't the way that they chose to go about it. So modern social justice movements are based in a different way of thinking. And that different way of thinking produced greater results than the movements that are based in different ways of thinking. So it's quite obvious that those movements are getting more money, more attention, more success than something like the intactivist movement. Now you might say, well, those movements are talking about really important issues. So of course they're going to find that level of success and attention. And I don't know that it's true that just having an important issue is enough to generate that level of success and attention. I agree that they're talking about important issues. But the thing that I'm curious about is what's producing that level of attention and success. Because I think that there are a lot of issues that are really important in the world that don't get the level of attention and success that they deserve. And so if someone is achieving that level of success, I want to model it. I want to understand it. I want to understand why they're achieving that level of success so that I can do the same thing on the issues that I'm involved in and that I've been working on for a long time. So I started to read the underlying theory behind those issues. Modern social justice movements are not based in human rights liberalism. They're based in something called critical theory. Critical theory is a way of looking at power and social constructions in the world. Now, I could do an entire podcast just talking about critical theory and trying to define that term. And I know that different people are going to have slightly different definitions of what that means. There's one that is the historical definition that goes back to the Frankfurt School in Germany that has a very precise historical definition. Some people use that term as a shorthand for critical race theory, which is the application of certain ideas to issues of race and power and racism. Some people use it to describe very broadly a whole series of leftist movements. And when I use it, I'm using the broadest definition possible because I'm not interested in just the historical Frankfurt School or something like that, or just the application of a certain way of thinking to a particular issue. I want to understand the underlying principles. And so I read all the theory I could. And I started to apply that to the issue of circumcision. I thought, what would it look like if we grounded this issue just in critical theory instead of human rights? In other words, if I took away your ability to make the human rights argument, and I said, that argument is totally true. People have a human right to their own body. Circumcision is a violation of that right. Totally agree. What if you had to make a different argument? How would you do that? Because if you were in a society that did not recognize human rights, then that argument wouldn't work. And the example that I don't know if I want to get into the book material too much, but there are some ways that I talk about that in the book and why that's important. And one of the reasons I think it's important is that the dominant institutions of society are not making their decisions in liberalism right now. They're making them in a way that's very much influenced by critical theory and modern social justice movements. So if they're not doing things on the basis of human rights, but they're doing it on the basis of ideas like equity, that means you need to appeal, if you're going to appeal to those institutions, you need to appeal to them in the language and ideology that they actually have. And when I started to apply theory to this issue, a few things happened that were really interesting. First, the arguments got stronger, like way stronger. And I found that if you made the argument against genital cutting, against circumcision in critical theory, it was actually way more powerful than the human rights argument, to the point where I don't even know if I need the human rights argument to make this case. Second, it had implications, not just for this issue, but for the treatment of children as a whole. In other words, if you think about social justice and critical theory as being about helping or protecting oppressed and marginalized classes of people, there is no group more oppressed and marginalized than children. And so if you think of children as an oppressed class, as a marginalized class, then all of the principles of social justice that apply to oppressed and marginalized classes apply to children. Now, they apply a little differently because children are a very unique class, and I talk about what that means in the book. But what I found is that when I applied these ideas to this issue, it had implications not just for the issue, but for all of the ways in which we treat children. And in fact, all of the other different social justice issues that it intersected with. And that's part of the reason the book began to expand, as I realized this is not just about circumcision anymore. This is about the treatment of children as a social justice issue. And the third thing that happened was that problems the movement against circumcision had had for years became immediately clearer. There's a whole field in modern social justice known as epistemic injustice. And epistemic justice is the idea that knowing who is allowed to know and the ways in which knowledge is collected could also be a social justice issue. And one of the things I've noticed when people try to talk about the issue of genital cutting and circumcision is that it's really challenging just to talk about it. There's all of these bits of cultural myth and social constructions and just language that is used on this issue to obscure the truth rather than reveal it. And critical theory, epistemic justice, this stuff is all about how language creates power and how to deconstruct language that creates oppression and replace it with language that empowers people. And so issues the movement has had for years, I believe, will be solved if people adopt certain ideas from this book and apply it. And that's part of the reason that I think that this book could be more impactful than the film. Because I am proposing in this book, and it is a bold claim and thing to do, I know, but I'm proposing an entirely new way of not just looking at this issue, but looking at the way that we treat children. And turning that into a social justice issue using the principles of critical theory. And by the way, so you know the amount of work that's gone into this book, the current draft has over 400 academic footnotes in it. So every time I say that theory says this, or a particular theorist says this, I give you the citation so that you can learn some of that theory yourself. So right now, the book is called Children's Justice, and it is about applying the ideas of social justice and critical theory to how we treat children. And like I said, I'm planning to release it in February 2020. So if you'd like to support me doing that, you know, at the end of this podcast, I usually have a message saying that you can support the podcast at brendanmorata.com/show, become a member. I'm basically using that as a Patreon. And the reason I use that as a Patreon is because if you actually use Patreon, one, they can ban you at any time, but two, they actually take 10% of the money that comes in. Whereas the platform I'm using now, Gumroad, does not take as significant a percentage of the money that comes in. So just so you know, that's basically my Patreon, the way that you can support me while I'm writing this book. There has already been a significant amount I've put into the writing of the book. I hired an editor to help me to go through it. And actually, someone who'd edited books on critical theory that have been published by academic publishers. So if I'd gone with an academic publisher, then this is the type of person they would have had edit the book. And I figured I would just go to that person ahead of time and get those notes for the writing process. So I've done that. I'll have to get a book cover. If I want to do an audiobook, I'll have to get that professionally recorded and edited, all of these things. So If you'd like to support me as I work on the book, please support the podcast. I am basically using that as a Patreon donation model for the show. I'm sure you will hear me talk a lot about this book over the coming months, because there is so much in this book. You know, if you've ever read academic theory, it's not like reading a regular book. A regular book you can kind of skim, get the gist of it. With academic theory, the author will often put a big idea in a paragraph and then just reference the name that they give that idea throughout the rest of the paper. And if your eyes glazed over and you missed it, good luck understanding the rest of it. So this book has a similar level of density to the ideas in it. There's a lot there. But there are also things that are going to be very clear and useful and easily communicated to others that I think are really going to transform not just your understanding of these issues, but hopefully the world as a whole. Which I know, a bold claim, but this is going to be a very bold book. So there's much more I could say, but I'll save it for later. I have a podcast planned talking about the book and things related to it in the future. The book, which is coming out February 2020, is going to be called Children's Justice. And I hope you'll get a copy when it comes out, and keep subscribing to this podcast for more updates. Talk to you all later.